Okay, everyone's settling down now for this evening's talk. I was given a number of suggestions for this evening's talk, and I've allowed them just to be all put together in my brain, and what the result came out was from an experience I had some years ago when I was invited to give a talk as part of a Amnesty International function. They were talking about, I think, violence or anger in the world, and they had the former Archbishop Carnley and myself, and there's a couple of other people as well, I can't remember who they were now, and they called it great thinkers on this subject. So I was supposed to be a great thinker, and I objected because I don't think very much. So I'm really a great non-thinker. Because when you meditate, you're not thinking so much. But it gave me the idea of the talk. It's about great thinking. What does that actually mean? Because the opposite of great thinking is stupid thinking. And the stupid thinking is takes in a lot of the subjects which people ask me to talk about. Things like jealousy, like fault-finding. Those sorts of stuff which creates lots of suffering for people in this world. Because people live by their thoughts and they fashion their world by their thoughts, the thinking is such an important part to our happiness or to our pain that we're going to talk about thinking this evening. Or rather wise thinking. Or rather smart thinking. As soon as I had the idea of smart thinking, I always remembered one of my heroes when I was a kid, Batman and Robin. Because Batman would always turn around to Robin and say, "Smart thinking, boy wonder." So this is where we find what that really means, smart thinking, boy wonder. What is smart thinking? First of all, the best type of thought, the smartest thought, the best thought of all, is silence. In other words, no thought. Because we think so much, we never see what's really happening. And our thoughts just too often are negative. It's amazing what you can understand in silence. And all the thinking stops. Because when we just listen to the thinking in our mind, it's not reality. It's one step removed from the real world. It's our description, how we interpret it, how we try and make sense of it, but it's not the real world. If you think about Ajahn Brahm, who is he anyway? The experience and the thoughts are two different things altogether. And you'll find that in life. So sometimes that we should understand that the thinking is very deceptive. And there's much more happiness in silence. But for many that's a big thing to ask. So, we'll go to the next stage. First, one step backwards towards suffering. If you're going to think at all, at least why don't you think good, positive, nice thoughts? Because if you think positive thoughts, and you can do this, at least you create happiness instead of the misery in this world. To tell you what I mean, like somebody asked me, can we talk about jealousy? What is jealousy? It's actually just a whole bunch of stupid thoughts which have no real meaning. When I was in Singapore last week, because that Sister Ajahn Wayama was here instead, because I was up there teaching lots and lots of talks. At the Zen conference which I was at, one of my presentations was Buddha in the Office. Because, as you know, that for many years I've tried to make these Buddhist teachings something which is applicable to your daily life. So you can come here, you can be entertained by a few jokes, be inspired, but also be able to go home and become better people. And many of you live half your lives in an office. Even I live most of my life in an office these days. In fact, somebody told me they just got a letter or from their son. He got a job, he's out of work for weeks and months, and he finally got a job in the office in Kalgoorlie somewhere. Until his father found out what office it was. It was the unemployment office, he was just getting the dole. But real office work I say that some of the problems is like the politics, and the politics is about promotion and who's going to get what job and when. We're so jealous of someone else who gets preferred ahead of us, who gets a promotion, who gets the plum job. And I was telling people, well, that's stupid thinking. Wise thinking is to understand if somebody else gets promoted above you, then they're the ones who have to do all the extra work. No one in their right mind in my monastery wants to get promoted to being abbot when they see how hard I work. About a year ago when we had a tsunami in Penang, because I was in Penang that day, my second monk, Ajahn Chittamala, was very worried and concerned. Because if I had been swept away, he would have to be abbot. That was the only reason why he rang straight away. Is Ajahn Babu all right? Is Ajahn Babu all right? It was not compassion. It was more like concern and worry. Because sometimes we think, oh, wouldn't it be great to get that better job? And it's stupid, because if you get that better job, it's not better at all. It's just different, that's all. And the jealousy, which is like thinking, oh, if only I were like her. Oh, if only I could give a talk like Ajahn Brahm. Please don't try and give it. That's my biggest mistake, opening my mouth. Now I'm not allowed to close it. People sometimes ring up, I first get into my hall at 6:30 in the morning to have some breakfast, and straight away, telephone call from Ajahn Brahm. What was I saying last week? That somebody rang up because their dog died. Another person rang up from the United States because they're having some marital trouble. And I get that every morning at 6:30. Until late at night. It's a crazy life I live. So, don't ever try and be successful. That's the worst thing you could ever do. Because you... Well, is it really? And the answer is, of course, no. If you start thinking about it, you think, oh, the other person would always be happier than I am. And some of you heard this classic story from my life. Actually, it's not in the book of Opening the Door of Your Heart. Maybe I should write chapter 2. Because this is one of the stories which really deserves to be in that book. The story, they're not here today, I don't think, the two Thai girls, two sisters, who came to see me many years ago. And after the meal, you know, they feed the monk the meal, to soften me up, and then they ask all these tough questions afterwards. And they came to have some counseling. And they were sisters, they came together. The first one, her problem was her husband. She was having a terrible marriage, and basically she wanted to get divorced. And so I was talking backwards and forwards, you know, about such stuff. You know, actually, that I heard some nice marriage jokes while I was in Singapore. You know that they say that love is blind and that marriage is the result of love. So really marriage is an institution for the blind. I'm going to tell that next time I marry somebody. They say that when you're going out with your sort of future partner, you hold her hand out of love. When you marry, you hold her hand out of self-defense. Yeah, I don't think I'd better go down that path any longer. But anyhow, that she was having trouble with her husband. And after I sort of calmed her down and said, well, it's not that bad, you know, being married. And then I calmed her down. And I asked her sister, what's your problem? And her sister's problem? She was single. She couldn't find a husband. And so the solution came to me as a brainwave. They wouldn't buy it. I said, look, you've got a husband you don't want. She wants one. It's obvious. Your sisters, anyway. But that was just messing around. In the end, just I told him, this is where I started. That lovely way of looking at life. I say, you, madam, with a husband, you've got married person suffering. You, sister, who's got no husband, you've got single person suffering. That's all it is. And if you find a husband, you won't have single person suffering again. You'll have married person suffering. If you get divorced and get rid of your wife, or husband rather, you won't have married person suffering ever again, but you'll have single person suffering. And isn't that a beautiful way of actually looking at what happens when we try and change our external situations rather than changing our mind? We might change our job, we might change our marital status, we might sort of even change from being a layperson to a monk or a monk back to a layperson, whatever you want to do. Move jobs. If you move from Australia, you know, to, say, London, a big city, sure, you know, you haven't got Dullesville suffering anymore, but then you have like big city suffering instead. So when we think of like jealousy, that's really the answer there. You're jealous because you think, oh, if only we're like them, if only I could do what they do. But really, you're just changing one type of suffering for another type of suffering. Some people are working and they want to give up work. Some people haven't got a job and they're looking desperately for a job. Isn't that the case? Sometimes we're just changing one form of suffering to another. So, instead of being jealous, we should be wise. And what the wise is saying, all this thinking about, oh, once I do this, then it'll be wonderful, be beautiful, be happy. This is what I do sometimes. I think, oh, if only I wasn't the abbot. If only sort of somebody else was the abbot. I remember Ajahn Sumedho saying this years ago. He's the abbot of our monastery in England. He said, you know, I'm just so fed up with all these people coming to ask me questions. One day I'm going to do something really scandalous. He said, so no one will come and listen to me anymore. And I can have a peaceful life. But of course, good monks can't do anything scandalous. But anyhow, the idea is that sometimes we think, it's not the job you have to do. It's not the position in the company. It's not your gender. It's not your situation you happen to be in right now. That isn't the problem, because if you change it, you just change one type of suffering for another type of suffering. But you can actually end all suffering by this beautiful acceptance. Which is why I titled that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. It was the story of my father who said, whatever you do in your life, son, the door of my house, he said, but later I adapted it to the door of my heart will always be open to you. Now that wasn't just loving kindness, that was wisdom there. This moment, my job, my situation, whatever's happening to me, my cancer, going to jail, dying, somebody else dying, having to work so hard, having no work at all, the situation is not important. What's important is our attitude towards it. Whether we can be at peace, embrace this moment as it is, embrace being an abbot, having to work so hard. My door of my heart's open to that. Sure, there's a lot of tiredness, but there's a lot of joy as well. And if, you know, I have nothing to do, well, sure, there's, you know, nobody likes me, but at least I can be peaceful. Whatever it is, if you embrace this moment, there's always an incredible sense of peace and stillness, and most importantly, freedom. You don't need to change your job to be free. You don't need to change your illness to be free. You don't need to go another place to be free. Because freedom is not found with people you like, or getting the best job, or being rich. Freedom can only happen right now with being at peace with where you are. Every time we run and go somewhere else, where are we going to? You can look where you're going to, but I like to look where I've been running from. What have you been running away from? All your desires and aspirations, your goals, your dreams. Yeah, you're chasing something, but you're also running away from something else. So instead of looking for what you're chasing or where you're heading, how about looking, what are we running away from? And in the end, we find we're running away from right here, right now, and that's always the place we've been running away to. The goals or the destinations, that's not the important point. It's where you're coming from, what you're running from. That's what we should be looking for. And what we're running away from is this present moment here and now. We're running away from contentment, from peace, from stillness. No wonder we never found happiness or stillness, peace of mind. So after a while, we learn how to stop thinking and just to know Let's realize this moment as it is, just here in Nolamara on a Friday night. This is good enough. When you start thinking it's good enough, it's more than good enough. Because once it's good enough, you have no work to do anymore. You stop thinking and become beautifully silent. So where's the room for jealousy? Jealousy is just unwise thinking. It's a fault finding with your position, measuring yourself against somebody else. And why do you always measure that way? And I sometimes that this idea of measuring, because I was a scientist before, a physicist, sometimes you put so much effort into measuring accurately. But you can't really measure accurately. I remember Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But later on I learnt Buddha's uncertainty principle. How can you judge anybody? Even knowing yourself is hard enough. So if you can't judge, how can you actually think? Sometimes we think, oh, that person's a bastard. That person's so wonderful. This person's stupid, but that guy's really sharp. Is that really a wise judgment? Who's doing the measurement anyway, and how can you? So I learnt, as a Buddhist, a long time ago, not to measure my friends. And then, after I learnt not to measure my friends, to accept them as they are, and to enjoy them as they are, when I didn't measure them, I gave them a sense of freedom to be who they are. And they showed me parts of them I never expected, like my monks in my monastery. I try not to measure them. We just finished our rains retreat on Wednesday. You know, in a monastery, we don't give report cards. You know, like you do in school, at the end of a school term, you give a report card A, B, C, D, E, or F. It might be fun, actually, to give a report to all my monks, and give them a card. We can't do that, because how can you measure other people? Sometimes that we think, oh, this guy's a great meditator, or she can't meditate at all, or this girl is really wise and compassionate, but this one isn't. But is that really fair? Many years ago, I looked at the simile of a school, because I was a school teacher before I was a monk, and I had to measure kids in the school. In the 1 year I was a school teacher. You know what I did? Because I had a class, I only had them for one period a week. At the end of the term, I hardly knew them. So I wrote down these meaningless words. You know, quite good, you know, all right, moderate. And as soon as I had 30 of these names, which meant nothing, I just put them one after the other against each name. Except for the kids who really stood out at the top and the naughty kids. Everyone else just got this moderate or good enough, could do better. But you can say that to anyone, can't you? And it was actually meaningless because I could not judge these people. And this judging is part of thinking. So often that thinking is like measuring life or measuring somebody else. And after all, I think, how can I do that? But if you are going to judge someone, if you are going to measure them, why don't you measure them, give them the benefit of the doubt? Isn't it the case in the Western legal system, people are innocent until they're proven guilty? Except if they're your partner. So why can't we just give life the benefit of the doubt? And that's one of the positive thoughts. If you're going to think at all, you might as well think in a positive light. And if you think in a positive light, that's always looking at the bright side, the best side. There's always something you can see which is good in people or good in life. Yeah, so I have to work hard as a monk. And I say this last weekend, I think I counted how many hours I did each day. I think it was a 16-hour day on Saturday and a 14-hour day on Sunday. Because it was Sunday, I didn't work so hard. That's actually from early morning, just always being with people, answering their questions for such a long time. Oh, isn't that wonderful to be able to serve so long? Sometimes people say, oh, that must be so tiring. I say, no, it's inspiring. Because you can teach and you can lead people. I told people when you're like Buddha in the office, I say, when you start a new job, or actually the series of things which happen in a job are measured by the four spirations. Do you know the four spirations? Actually, you don't, because I invented this in Singapore. The four spirations. You start in life when you go to sort of a new job with inspiration. And that usually comes close with aspiration. When you want to do something, you're inspired and you aspire to do something. People who join our committee are the same. They get inspired by these talks at this Buddhist society, then they aspire to help. But the next aspiration, which soon comes afterwards, is called desperation. When it doesn't work, or you get fed up. And of course, you know, the last aspiration is expiration. When you leave. And too often that's the series, the source of sort of these series which we all go to, whether it's in a new job or relationship. Aspiration, inspiration, desperation, and expiration. The four aspirations of life. But it does not have to be that way. Why, when we get inspired, we aspire, why do we always get despair afterwards with what we do? And especially, like, why do sort of, you know, some communities or religious groups, or, you know, you come in and it's just so inspiring and so wonderful. Why is it that sometimes it all falls apart, like in a relationship? We're so good at the beginning. Where's that sort of goodness and inspiration gone? And it's gone because you haven't looked after it. So often, you know, because it's wrong thinking. Sometimes we think, oh, it's going to be all right forever and ever. Oh, it's so wonderful. But, you know, it's our attitude which makes it beautiful. Beauty is not out there. Beauty is inside of you. It's what you add onto this world. For example, if you ever go to my monastery, you find that on our shrine there's three new Buddha statues. And these Buddha statues, I don't think I said this 2 weeks ago, I don't think so. These two Buddha statues were offered by a Thai lady who went all the way to Bangkok to offer these two statues. Some monks think they're ugly because they're gaudy and they're like simple Buddha statues. But I put them up there, not because I like the way they look, because I like where they came from. Because a couple of people, a group of people, went all the way to Thailand, especially to get those statues for us. And I don't care if they look like Mickey Mouse. Simply because they put so much effort and so much love to get them. That's beautiful for me. And so I've got like a different character of beauty. I can see beauty in something which is ugly sometimes. Because it doesn't matter what's on the outside. It's something in the inside which you can see. And that's sometimes why you can look at the situation which you have in life. Look at your husband, your wife, your job. You can, if you're a wise thinker, and this is what I mean by a great thinker, you can see beauty in anything. And this is actually part of the way I've taught in my life, and the way I have practiced in life. Whatever happens to you, you can always find something which is joyful. Last Wednesday, I was teaching at the Cancer Support Association in Cottesloe. They invite me there once every year. And actually, they being the Cancer Support Association, they have quite a high turnover, so there's always new people to listen to my jokes. It's all right to laugh. It's called black humour, because they always die. The last year's lot have already died. You've got a new lot next time. There's nothing wrong with dying. What do you expect? They would be going to the Cancer Support Association if they're going to live for a long time. So what's wrong with dying? Dying is fun. You don't have any worries anymore. It solves lots of problems. And also, you know, when you're a good person, you go to heaven afterwards. If you're not a good person, you can always bribe someone by giving a big donation before you die. That's what a lot of people do, you know. They get really guilty right at the very end. But of course, you just can't do any bribery. The point is that sometimes when a person's had enough, they're old, they're, you know, sickly, and isn't the quality of life not much good? What's wrong with letting them go? So I think dying is a wonderful thing. It's like the ending. The ending of a day is the most beautiful time, I think, anyway. Especially here in Perth. The end of a day, you look out on the ocean and you see these amazing sunsets. But you don't see the sunset in the morning or midday. You only see it at the end of a day. So sometimes death can be just so beautiful, so inspiring. And I've seen many inspiring deaths in my life. And maybe that I'll try my best when I die to make it inspiring and good fun. Maybe just tell a joke at the end. Whatever it is, I don't know. But anyhow, you've probably heard it before anyway, but never mind. But the point is, you can look at anything with a sort of, with a sense of fun, with a sense of joy. It's just what we add to it is a problem. And so that our thinking needs to be changed, needs to be developed. So whatever happens to us in life, you know, if it's a cancer we've got, oh great, now I've got time to rest. Because when you're sick, you can go into bed and people look after you and you don't have to do anything and they're really kind. And when you're about to die, people come and say sorry for all the rotten things they've done before. They always want to make amends. It's beautiful when you die. You get all your family to come and see you. If you want to have your family come and visit you and they haven't visited you for a long time, just send them an email saying, I'm sick, I'm dying. And you're not lying, because everyone is dying. It just takes a little bit longer than other people. It's true, isn't it? You're not lying, not breaking your precepts. We're all dying. I'm dying. So there's lots of benefits on these things. So this is what I'm saying. That sometimes the way we use our thoughts, it's just creating more unhappiness for ourselves. And I can't see the purpose of that. So why not actually develop our thought to see something positive in whatever happens? If you miss your plane, then you've got a wonderful chance to have a rest in the airport. And if something goes wrong, so somebody, for example, steals your car. Isn't that wonderful? Now I can exercise, because I needed to exercise a lot, you know, I'm just too fat. And again, if I'm too fat, if any of you notice that I've gained weight during my range retreat, it's not my fault. It's your fault. You feed me too much. And anyway, what's wrong with being fat? Sometimes, you know, in the old days, actually you're like the Buddha. You know that fat Buddha? You know, so that's our tradition to be fat in Buddhism, so you don't have to worry about it. Or as somebody once said, that there was this study which was done in the UK years ago. I only keep those studies which actually support my attitudes and views. Because this particular study was saying that they had some people had high cholesterol, and they tested out the people with high cholesterol who went on one of these diets and those who didn't, to see whether it actually affected their longevity. And they did a long study, many people, they found it didn't affect your longevity at all. The health benefits from eating health food were completely outweighed or balanced by being depressed by not getting the food you like. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? People like to hear that. I thought that was a great line. So the point is that sometimes it's the thinking which kills us, the worrying. You know that famous joke, I've told it so many times, but I can't help repeating it, because this was from George Burns. 99 years old, it was his 99th birthday he said this, because the interviewer is saying, you are still drinking alcohol, like whiskey, lots of it every day. You're eating all this junk food, you know, McDonald's and KFC, you're smoking, and you're not exercising, you're staying up late at night. And he said, aren't you worried about your lifestyle? And his response was, I'm not worried about my lifestyle. My wife was, and she died 20 years ago. It's a worry which kills you more than anything else, which is the bad thinking. So if you're actually jealous of somebody, my goodness, you're kidding yourself. Your thinking is causing stress. It's not the job you're doing which causes the stress, it's the thinking about it causes the stress. That is the problem. This story is in my book. It's the story of like pushing the wheelbarrows. Because this was the time Ajahn Chah was building his monastery. And it was done by monk power. Yes, he had enough money to get contractors, but it was cheaper having monks. And actually, I needed the exercise, I needed to make good karma, so thank you very much, my teacher, for making me work. But like many people, I thought, I didn't become a monk to push wheelbarrows. I became a monk to meditate, to go to some nice cave and sit for hours in the deepest of meditations and learn how to fly through the air, not learn how to push wheelbarrows. What do you want to be a monk for that for? But there I was in the jungles of Thailand, with swarms of mosquitoes around you, sweating, being made to work from about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning till 10 p.m. at night, with no other meal, just work, work, work. That was tough, but I had faith. But even faith doesn't last long. After 3 days of that, I had enough. But fortunately, that by 3 days we'd moved the earth, which Ajahn Chah wanted us to move. And of course, you know, we always have our goals. We think, only another day, only another half a day, only another hour, then we're finished. Now that's dangerous, thinking about goals, because if you think about goals, when this is going to be finished, you're asking for trouble. Because Ajahn Chah went to another monastery the next morning. Ajahn Liam was the second monk. He was in charge. He told us, no, the earth's in the wrong place, move it. 3 more days of hard work, sweating, being bitten by mosquitoes, tired, when I should have been meditating. For 3 days we slaved. And after, it was only 3 days, that's not long, and I still had my faith. And after 3 days we'd finished. Ah, at last. Then Ajahn Chah came back. You know the story. You've put it in the wrong place. I told you over there, move it. Now that's when I lost it. Quite understandable. But I started complaining, swearing. Because one of the nice things about being a foreign monk, you could swear in your own language and no one could understand what you're saying. Unfortunately, they may not understand the words, but they can see your body language. They knew I was really suffering. Another 3 days of this, when is it going to end? And that was when one of the monks came up to me. And I really thank him for the rest of my life for what he said. Because what he said to me, he said, look, pushing the wheelbarrows is easy. Thinking about it is the difficult part. That was such a wonderful, simple Buddhist teaching. And that's why I'm sharing it with you again. Because that will solve you so much suffering and pain in life. Pushing the wheelbarrows is easy. Thinking about it is a difficult part. And I understood what he said. I stopped thinking about pushing the wheelbarrows. I just did it. Just pushed them. You know, they got lighter. They had the same amount of dirt in them. But because I wasn't complaining and thinking all the time, I actually had more energy. And those 3 days went very quickly when you don't think about it. But I learned so much. I probably learned more from that experience than weeks and months of sitting quietly in the lotus position, meditating on my breath. It was the attitude problem which I had, because I didn't just learn how to push wheelbarrows, I learned about life. Being an abbot. Thinking about it is a hard part, doing it is very easy. Sometimes you give talks in 3,000, 4,000 people. Isn't that scary? It is if you think about it. Or going on live TV. What happens if you pick your nose? By the time you think know what you're doing, it's too late. It's all over Southeast Asia. Actually, I just remember now what I just did is being videoed. This is all on the internet now. Ah! But thinking about it is a difficult part, isn't it? That's why people have fear. Fear of speaking in public, fear of going to an interview, fear of going to an examination, fear of having a tennis match, fear of a court case. Actually, the experience itself is not bad. It's the thinking about it what kills you. Even going to the doctor to have a biopsy. You've got a little lump somewhere. Ah! So thinking about it is a killer, isn't it? Sometimes people don't sleep at night and they're going to get some tests from the doctors. trouble is that, you know, they go for the test and the doctor says, we're not quite sure, we'll give you another test. That's more sleepless nights. So the point is, the actual procedures itself are very easy. And even having cancer is easy. Even dying is easy. So thinking about it is a problem. So why can't we stop this bad thinking? And if we're going to think at all, think positively. A great opportunity to push a wheelbarrow, to make some good karma, to do something for the world. A great opportunity being sick. Because when I'm sick, or when you're sick, all of your loved ones, your friends and relations have got an opportunity to show their compassion and care. There weren't any sick people in this world. Who can we be kind to? It's a great thing being stupid. As I said to that school child many years ago, I told a story in Singapore last week, because in Singapore many of them are Mahayana Buddhists, and Mahayana Buddhists have the idea of a bodhisattva, someone who sacrifices even their life for the happiness of other beings. So at the end of the year, one of the kids in my class came bottom. As one kid would have to do every year. He came 30th in my class of 30. So when I gave out the report cards, you could imagine how he felt. He'd have to face his parents as the bottom of the class. And I looked at him, he looked so depressed. And being a kind teacher, I thought, I'm going to cheer him up. I went up to this poor young boy and said, I explained to him about Buddhism. They knew I was a Buddhist, even as a school teacher. And I explained to him about Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is someone who sacrificed their own well-being for the sake of others, and that's you. You've taken this terrible position at bottom of the class, so no one else has to endure this ignominy, this pain. And I said, you're such a kind person. Of all the children in this class, you have taken this terrible position on yourself. Wow, you're just so compassionate and so kind. You deserve a medal. We should have a special prize for you. And of course he thought I was crazy, which was half true. But what it did was it cheered him up. It got him out of his negative thinking about, oh, isn't it terrible, I'm bottom of the class. This is where jealousy comes from, when you think that, you know, you're the ugly one. You know, you're the stupid one, you're the hopeless one, you can't do anything. Oh, you're so lucky being the ugly one, being the stupid one, being the hopeless one. People can leave you alone, you can have some peace at last. And actually that's interesting, because being a monk, you know, you do counsel all sorts of people. And every now and again you get some sort of TV star or movie star or someone who's very blessed with beauty or be really handsome and strong. And actually get to know what it's like to be like that. I mean, being very, very beautiful is a terrible, almost like a burden on a woman. Being sort of attractive and famous is a terrible burden on a man. When you actually learn what it's like, you wouldn't want that for the world. So, just being you is the very best. In fact, you couldn't do better than who you are. When you think like that, you have peace and you have contentment. You have this positive thinking that whatever's happening to your life, whoever you are, is wonderful. And you can make so much out of being who you are. You know, being who you are is called contentment, it's called coming home, it's called peace. And isn't that the end of our life? Not as, I mean, death, like enlightenment, being at peace with yourself, one with yourself, content with yourself, warts and all. So we have this beautiful positive thinking in Buddhism. The Buddha said that the only thing he teaches is suffering and the end of suffering. That's why all these talks I give here sometimes say, what's this got to do with Buddhism? Can't we have some more formal Buddhism, you know, dependent origination, four noble truths, three characteristics or whatever, all this theoretical stuff. But yeah, it is theoretical stuff, but put down into the earth, ending your suffering and your pain, and giving you happiness and peace and joy. So we work hard because that's our duty, but we never complain. No, we don't even complain in our mind. There's too much fault-finding in our world. If you can change it, do it. If you can't change it, be at peace with it. And what you can't change, it's not you just being at peace with it, you can actually grow and learn from it. Sometimes you might be married to someone who's, you know, don't know why you got married to them, but there you are, you're stuck with them for the time being. Sometimes they may not be the best, they may not be so caring, they may be even smelly. But if they are, there's always something you can do about it. You can always stuff some cotton wool in your nose, I don't know. Or you can make suggestions to them. Sometimes those suggestions work, sometimes they don't work. But sometimes at least you can be kind. What was it, that story from Mother Teresa, when she picked up this man on the streets of Calcutta who had a cancer and who was really stinking, like rotten flesh can only stink? I don't know that, now I've smelt rotten flesh many times when I used to go to see autopsies in Thailand. And that's, I don't know what it is, the smell of human death. It's got something psychological to it as well. It's the most offensive smell you can possibly have. At least in my book, all the smells I've smelt, that's the worst one. And, you know, sometimes you wonder why that is. It must be something psychological. It reminds you of your own death, or it's something which is genetically put into us. I've actually forgotten what my train of thought was now. You see, because this is, I was talking about thinking. And like being silent, sometimes you just go back into your silent thought and forget what you're thinking about in the first place. But never mind, that's what happens. What was I thinking about? Mother Teresa, thank you very much, yes. Oh, you are so kind. And is it wonderful that I actually forgot my train of thought? Because if I hadn't stopped my train of thought, it wouldn't have given the opportunity up for Jenny to make some good karma this evening in public. So it wasn't a wonderful thing that I stopped my train of thought. So you never get embarrassed about making mistakes like this, because you can always do something with your mistake. So thank you for that. What was it, Mother Teresa? Yes, Mother Teresa. Smelly person she was picking up from the street. Because, you know, cancers have got lots of, especially untreated cancers, lots of stuff. And then people asked her afterwards, weren't you sort of, you know, offended or repelled by the smell of that man who'd been in the gutter literally for days on end? And she said, no, I didn't sort of even think about his smell. I just felt about his pain and what he needed. And that was a beautiful story there, that sometimes what are we focusing on? If somebody smells, are we just focusing on one thing and not thinking about other things? Why is it we focus on like their bad smell rather than, you know, their pain? Or, you know, something else about them? Why is it we always focus on the faults? So after a while, you know, maybe there might be something else there. You know, there is that flower we have in Australia. I remember, actually, he's here this evening. He used to do the flowers every week. And one day when I came in here, just on a Friday afternoon, getting ready for the talk, I smelt literally what smelt like dog shit. And I had to look at my shoes. I thought I'd stepped in something on the way in here. But I checked my shoes, I didn't bring it in. And I checked everyone else's shoes. I couldn't smell any of that dog poo on their shoes either. And I was really, because you could really, it was really strong. And then I sort of literally followed my nose, sniffed around, find out where the smell was coming from. And there, it was in the vase of flowers. It was one of these flowers, it was just so yellow and beautiful and delicate, but it smelt of dog poo. Now, that's actually one of the flowers we have in Western Australia. Because it is used, pollinated by flies instead of bees. And it's used actually to attract the flies, they have to attract the flies actually to get the pollen from one flower to another. So it exudes this beautiful fragrance of dog poo. And the person who actually bought it that day had a cold, so he couldn't smell it. It looked nice, but he couldn't smell it. So even though it smells of dog poo, you can actually, instead of looking at the smell, look at something else. There's something beautiful there. It's a beautiful flower which belongs in our ecosystem. Maybe it might not be the nicest flower to smell, but it certainly was a very beautiful flower to look at. So why do we focus on one thing to the exclusion of others? Because we're all like that flower, really, aren't we? There's always part of us which smells of dog poo, and other parts which are very beautiful. You can never find a perfect flower. You can never find a perfect partner. You never find a perfect job. There'll always be some part of your job which is dog poo, and the other part which is so beautiful and wonderful and rewarding. If it was a perfect job, then why would they need to pay you? Remember, your payment, your salary, is a bribe for doing something you don't like doing. If anyone comes in and says you really enjoy your job, I'm going to tell your boss, and they're going to cut your pay. Are you enjoying the job? So, the point of this is that if we look upon the way we use our thought, we can actually train our thought to look at that positive, beautiful side. Whenever we see one of those flowers, we can look at the beautiful, fragrant petals and the rich colours. We don't have just to look at its smell. So if you've got a husband who smells, and I say this because someone asked me to talk about this tonight, they actually have got a husband who smells. How about looking at another part of him? His beauty. His tenderness. His humanity. His softness. Look at that. And I'll tell you something. If you look at their beauty, their kindness, their goodness, you will find the smell will decrease. It happens that way. Whatever you focus on tends to grow. You actually create your world. Each one of us. Whenever a Christian comes up and says, who created the world? The Buddhists always say, you did. And that's a very profound saying. So understanding, you create your world. You can create a heaven or a hell just with the way you use your thinking. And much of our practice as a Buddhist, I say practice the way we're conditioned. Just the way we come and listen to this brainwashing every Friday night. The way you empty your mind with meditation. You're actually reconditioning yourself to see something positive in the world. You get sick. Marvelous. Time for other people to be compassionate towards me. You die. Marvelous. You're teaching people the value of life. Now you lose your job. Marvelous. Now you've got time to serve at our Buddhist center. And there's lots of things which you can do later on. I'm sure our present soul will tell you what you can do if you lose your job. So you've got a chance to make lots of merit. Whatever happens to you in life, there's always a good way of thinking about it. So why do you think the bad way? It's just bad habit, that's all. You're just creating suffering for yourself, more pain for yourself, more pain for others. Fortunately, I've seen many, many people in my life have actually taken these teachings to heart, and terrible things happen to them, but they're always at peace with it. It's as if they've got not just a wheelbarrow to push, but a whole truck, a whole train load of dirt to push. They just get ahead and do it. Thinking about it is the hard part. Doing it is so easy. When I go off to teach, I look at my schedule sometime and it doesn't bear thinking about. So I don't think about it. Just do it. Sometimes I look at all the jobs I'm supposed to be doing. You know, global conference next year I'm supposed to be organizing. Retreat center building. There's a book I'm supposed to be proofreading. The next beautiful breath about my meditation teachings. Running a monastery. Doing this, doing that. Doesn't bear thinking about. So you just do it. And then you find your life is so easy. And if you try and meditate, how many people come along and say, oh, I can't meditate. Look, stop thinking about it. Just do it. Meditation is easy when you don't think about things. Well, if you're going to think about it, think positive. I can meditate. I can meditate. I can meditate. I can meditate. Instead of saying, oh, I can't. So whatever you're doing in life, change the way you think. And if you want to know how you do this, keep coming here long enough. Friday night, after you get the tape, play it to yourself subliminally after you go to sleep. It's completely brainwashed into you. And then you find, not only can you live with a partner in life, even if they do smell, because you see something else beautiful in them, even if they're not the best, you can actually appreciate that part of them, inside them, which is the nice part. You look at the good part inside another person. In Buddhism, we call that the Buddha nature. Everybody has got Buddha nature. Every experience has got Buddha nature. Everything has got this purity. The Buddha is just like a word for something pure, noble, wonderful, beautiful. Everything has got that. Even dog poo. And you know that's fertilizer for your mango tree. So old age, sickness and death has got this Buddha nature. When things go wrong, at the time you may wrongly think, oh, this is terrible, look what's happened to me. I say sometimes, aren't you lucky? So fortunate to have that beautiful experience, to learn. The tough part of life is where we learn how to love. People I know who've had it easy don't know what love is. They don't know what compassion is, how to open their heart. Sometimes it's the disappointments, the pains, the deep frustrations. Sometimes it's the agony of life which opens us out. At least it gives you the opportunity to do so. So, when these things happen, don't just think about it. If you do, welcome it. Imagine that. Anything which happens to you in life, you can welcome it. Sickness, pain, even death, welcome. Then how on earth can you ever have any suffering anymore? How you have peace, freedom? Other people you see. Sometimes people come to me. Rapists, murderers, people who have done terrible things. And you welcome them. And you see in their eyes that's the first person in years who's welcomed them, who's treated them as a person, not a criminal. That's why when you approach some people in jail who've done those terrible crimes and you look at them with welcoming, just how it's just such a rare thing. They cry. They know that someone has seen something in them which other people haven't seen for years. Healing starts. So whoever you meet in life, if you welcome them, you look at their beautiful Buddha nature inside, that's what grows, that's what they'll show to you. And then you can be a friend to anybody. You have no enemies left in the world. No one can be your enemy. They may try, but because of your heart, you will melt everybody. You're melting life. You're melting life into this beautiful, nutritious soup. It may not taste nice, but it's good for you. So this is about how to change the way we think. To train ourselves. Every time you have a bad thought, a negative thought, oh, just stop it. Don't think like that. Try and look for the Buddha nature in every experience which you have in life. Even in a divorce. You know what happens in a divorce? You learn about what relationships are. You look back and say, oh, maybe next time I won't be so critical. I really watch the way I speak. Because look, that's really hurt. I mean, big time hurt. Next time I'll be a bit more soft and careful. You can learn so much about what a relationship truly is. If you didn't have that experience, sometimes you just don't know. So anything which happens, we can make it beautiful. This is how we make a beautiful world. This is how you are one of the great thinkers. Or again, as Batman said to Robin, smart thinking, boy wonder. And that's the title of this talk this evening. Smart thinking, boy and girl wonder. Thank you. Okay, has anyone got any questions? Has anyone been thinking too much? Any question anyone has to say? Yeah, come on. Go for it.
Well-realized meditators especially ones which go to the jhana stage, six, seven, eight, claim that everything around us is illusion, big illusion. So I come from a country where 300,000 people were killed in the war.
Yep. Yep.
There were more than this couple hundred years. So I would like to know about that illusion from Buddhist perspective.
Okay, you ask a question about illusion. You say you come from a country where many hundreds of thousands of people have died in wars, the wars and conflicts all over today. Killed, yeah, not just killed, tortured, sometimes left to die for a long time. And my home country was England. And my parents, grandparents had all these horror stories about the Blitz, the Second World War, bombs. And this is not just terrorism where just a couple of bombs that just happen once a year, like in Bali. This is every night, not just one bomb. Hundreds, thousands of bombs falling from the sky. And that's even people who aren't combatants. So it's a terror time. But people actually said, that was just a wonderful time in London. People were helping each other. And they looked back with nostalgia. The pain, the suffering was huge. There was something else there. They looked upon that as one of the most glorious times of Londoners. Because they stuck together, they helped each other. And that was something which was almost, you can't say all did, but almost counted. The physical pain and suffering. But that's what I focused on this evening. There will always be wars when it's stupid people who think too much and who think negatively about others. And that's really what it is, a negative way of thinking. Not seeing the Buddha nature in our so-called enemies, people of different race, different religions, different gender, different countries. But when we're stuck with a war, we don't need to have revenge. We don't need to think, they killed my boy, I must kill two of theirs. That is the problem where it's revenge. And revenge, you know, comes from pride. You know, the problem with the Twin Towers was they did it to America, that's us. Their pride was shattered. They wanted us to thrash back as we do. But that's not the Buddhist way. The Buddhist way is to see, even in the terror of a war, in the pain of your children being blown up. Even there, in the very worst thing you can possibly imagine, there is another way. If there wasn't another way, there'd be no hope for this world. Wars will always go on. And the other way is seeing something deeper. That we die is not the problem. The way we die, how we live, that's where we should be looking at, not how long we live. Our situation, whether it's in poverty or wealth, health or sickness, that's not the problem. It's how we are healthy and how we are sick. That is the problem. Health and sickness will always be there. Unfortunately, the wars are part of the human condition. We limit them as much as we can. We used to have a Geneva Convention, which actually limited, just when we play wars, actually play by some sort of rules, limit the terrible things we do to each other. But unfortunately these days, some governments, just they don't want to play by the rules anymore. So this is what we should be doing. Practical steps. Ordinary people demanding of our governments that something like a Geneva Convention is applied. It doesn't matter what the person might know, you don't torture them. Sure, you may get some information this time. You're opening the doors to a terrible demon. We don't play by any rules whatsoever anymore. That's a way forward. One thing with Buddhism, that if it's not practical, it's not worth believing in. We try our very best. But if that happens to you, if you are a victim of torture, the Buddha actually said, and it's a powerful teaching, if people hold you down and torture you, he said the simile of the saw, they saw you limb from limb, just with a two-handed saw, not even a chainsaw, that's too quick, slowly. You know one of those old saws you have in the workshop? He said, if, monks, you have one thought of ill will towards your torturers, you're not a disciple of mine. He said, when you're being tortured, spread goodwill to your torturers. You think that's impossible. But you read some of these books by Tibetan monks who have been incarcerated in Chinese jails and tortured. They've done it. It's not impossible. Other people have done it. If you can do that, why do you get angry at your wife torturing you? All she says is words, yak, 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 yak. No reason to stop having goodwill towards your wife or your husband or anybody, especially yourself. That's Buddhism. That's Dhamma. Powerful. Brilliant. So, that's what we should be doing. Does that answer your question halfway? Because your question was a big one, so you take a long time to answer it fully. But it's not an illusion. Illusion, sorry, I didn't answer the first part. I call it delusion, because it's not illusion. Wars are real. Pain is real. Life is real. But it's actually, we add on something to it, which doesn't really belong. That's right. I agree with you. It was the big thinkers, the philosophers, people who thought too much. You know, I've got this theory that the Industrial Revolution in the West started with the discovery of coffee. Historically, it's actually quite accurate. Because once they discovered coffee, then people could think at twice the speed they normally did. And they sat around thinking about things. Instead of actually thinking about sort of how you can get your horse from A to B, let's try another way. Let's get a locomotive or a car or something. And still, even these days, apparently, somebody said that they would work as an intern in some sort of government department, I think just in Perth. And people in these government departments have about 10 cups of coffee a day. Now, that's just in Western Australia. Imagine what it's like in the White House. No wonder it's crazy there. It was crazy. Give me something to some bob or a button to push or something. I think it might be a bit of a joke, but I think there's a lot of truth in that. If they put every government agency on decaf, I think it would be a very more peaceful world. Anyway, that's another thing. So thank you for your question. Hopefully I answered it. Okay, any other question? Actually, we probably should finish off, should we? Now maybe one more question. Anyone got a question? Comment? Yeah, come on. Yeah, go for it. Okay, if you're feeling a lot of pain and it feels like torture, who should you wish goodwill to? Wish goodwill to your pain. I've done this before. We call it in English anthropomorphism. In other words, you look at a thing which isn't really a being, like a pain, look upon it as a being. Like sometimes people look at their car and they give it a name, like, you know, Emily or George or whatever. I don't know what you call your car. It's only a machine, but you give it a name and then you can actually be kind to it. So if you give your pain a name, like they've given this hurricane a name, Wilma. So give your, you know, give your pain a name, Katrina or Wilma or something. And hello, hi Wilma, thanks for coming to see me again. But once you actually can anthropomorphize, you can actually, you know, say, like, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. And a credible thing happens when you really do that. Obviously, if you can take a painkiller or something, take it. But if you can't, then there will always be, for each one of you sitting here, there'll be sometimes a pain you just cannot get rid of. Even the best palliative care would not do it. And that's the pain you have to accept. If you want to look at an inspiring story, in that my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, there's a poem by Jonathan Wilson Fuller. And the reason I put it in my book, with the permission of the author, it was a guy who had chronic pain. He wrote this amazing poem saying there are many types of pain. There's the pain, you know, which is useful, like when you touch something which is hot, it stops you burning yourself. There's other types of pain which you think has got no use at all. No, chronic pain, which just does not go away. You say, why is this here? It's not helping my body, it's not helping protect me, but it's a killer. A killer from within. But in this poem he said, but actually it has a purpose. What its purpose is teaching you how to be strong, how to be happy in spite of the pain. He said it's a hurdle, a great hurdle, which can only be done yourself. No one can hold your hand in that struggle. But he said, when you do it, and it can be done, you have this incredible sense of inner strength, of happiness in spite of the pain. And then you understand its purpose. That's the gist of his poem. But the reason I put it in there, because it was written when he was 9 years of age. A young boy who had this incredible allergy to everything, and in constant pain. 9-year-old kid wrote that. It's brilliant. If you can do it, just be kind to your pain. Welcome. The other story I'll tell you, I won't repeat it here, but it's in the book. The anger-eating demon. Read that one. Get out of here, pain, you don't belong. And it gets an inch bigger, more ugly, more offensive, harder to bear. You say, welcome, pain. And it gets smaller. The anger-eating demon story is one of the best. It's not my story, it was taught by the Buddha. It's a brilliant analogy on how to deal with the negative things in life. Read it. And many of your problems, even in meditation. Some of our monks were using the anger-eating demon from the meditation during the rains retreat. I don't want to be sleepy. I don't want to be restless. I want to be in jhana. Doesn't matter wherever you are. There's a demon in your head. That's all right. Even some of my monks having lust. The demon of lust came into them. I told them, say, welcome, demon. Thank you for coming to visit. I can't do that. They said, I'll just get even more lust. I'll end up disrobing. Oh, follow instructions. Welcome, lust. Thank you for coming to visit me. And they found, like everyone found, the demon gets an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive, less of a problem. It disappears. As does pain. Okay, thank you for that amazing question.